Hosea chapter 2, we'll be looking at in just a few moments. Do y'all have a good week? If you have a good week, raise your hand, just so I know. Okay. I'm sorry for the rest of you. Now, you know, it was an interesting week for me. I don't normally look forward to birthdays, so I turned another year older. But I didn't mind so much this year. For one thing, there's 58 pounds less of me than there was the same time last year. And I feel a whole lot better. Thank you. I mean, give Matt a hand. He's like, that's for you, Matt, because Matt did it. And I feel a lot better. I feel 20 years younger than I did the same time last year. And so that's been a wonderful thing. I've enjoyed it. Enjoyed getting fit so I can do more things with my kids. And you know, you haven't lived, dads, till you've done push-ups with your kids on your back. Okay, so just letting you know, that's something to strive for. And you're better off if you start when they're small, trust me. But so that's been quite an adventure. And but I was sitting around the dinner table with all 10 of my kids and my 3 grandbabies the other night, and I was just looking at what blessings they all are to me, and how so far at least they're all growing up to love and to serve the Lord and to please Him. That's so important to me. And I just realized, you know, right now as things stand, and of course, you know, you never know if you've done your good job as a parent till you see how your grandkids turn out. Because the Bible says the glory of old men is their grandchildren. So unless you know your grandkids are turning around, you don't really know if you've done a good job yet. So the pastor has a whole lot better clue on whether or not he's done a good job than I do at this point. But from what I see, I have great hopes for the future. And it just lets me believe that my life has been worthwhile, even if God were to call me home tomorrow, because I'm leaving a legacy behind me. And I hope all of you feel that way about your families as well, too, that you're leaving a legacy behind you that will be a blessing and not a curse to the world. And so I was so thankful for that. And that really kind of made my week. And then this morning I got a special blessing. And I don't know how many of you people understand what I'm about to say. I do know that Donald will understand what I'm about to say. He may be the only person here that gets this, unless some of you are as fanatical to attention and detail as he is. But I got a new family van to drive without a car payment. Let me tell you about this, because this is awesome. So I've been thankful for the family van we've had, but the one thing that gets me is sometime, probably shortly after we got it, a bolt in one corner of the hood broke. And so when you're going down the road, the hood is flapping the whole time. And it was causing the steering wheel to shake. And, you know, if you really know your car, you can tell how the engine's running by the steering column, can't you? Some of you guys, if you know what I'm talking about. Especially, it was a whole lot easier in those 69 Mustangs, though, Tim. You could really tell. You put your hand on the stick shift, you knew what was happening inside that engine. But you can feel it, and I was feeling the vibration there, and it was noisy and have a hard time holding conversation. And so I had talked to the mechanic, and the mechanic had quoted me a price for fixing it, and we just didn't have the money. Finally, I just said, okay, I put up with it for, you know, 2.5-3 years now, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm just going to do this because it's an irritant that's just sticking in my side. And so I told the mechanic, I says, you know, would you fix this? And he did, and then he told me, oh, no charge. Okay, now first of all, that's pretty cool. He likes me. I'm one of his most regular customers, but anyway. So he fixed that thing for me free. So I'm driving on the way to church this morning. The hood's not flapping. The interior of the car is quiet. The steering wheel's not shaking. I thought, I got a new van. No payments. A new van, you know, that just felt awesome. That was kind of a great way. Now, see, a lot of people wouldn't appreciate that. And I don't think anybody else knows for a while until I pointed out how quiet it was. And finally the girls say, oh, yeah, it is quieter in here, you know. But it was a big deal for me. I'm just watching the hood the whole way here. But, you know, it's interesting that it's the little things like that that annoy us. And it's the little things, I think, that get under our skin in a marriage and work to tear down the kind of fellowship that we should have. And every now and then you've got to stop and take a look at your marriage and figure out where the bolts are broke. And fix it. so that you can enjoy the peace and the quiet and the steadiness, so that you can have a smooth ride, as it were. And so we need to pay attention to those little things. So what I want to do, last time we talked about the marriage basics, but I want us to talk about restoring your marriage, or making your marriage what it ought to be. If maybe things are just, maybe it needs a tune-up, maybe it needs a trip to have the hood fixed. So let's review a little bit where we were last week. First of all, we just reminded ourselves from Scripture of what the purposes of marriage were. Part of it was companionship, to ask somebody to be your friend and be with you. Part of it was contentment, to learn to be content with just your spouse, and to be content not with worldly things, but with relationships. And then we talked about how it completes you. Yes, it is true that the Bible says in Colossians that we are all made complete in Christ, who's the fullness of the Godhead bodily. But that's talking about with respect to salvation. The fact is that God reached into Adam's side, pulled a part of Adam out to make Eve, and ever since then, man has had a longing to reunite with the part that was taken out of them. And so there's this longing to be together. There's this longing for companionship. And then one of the purposes for marriage is childbearing, because this is God's way of taking a Christian couple and having them raise up a godly seed. See, marriage isn't just about us. It's about the glory of God. And part of the glory of God is raising a godly seed to serve Him. One of my greatest joys in life is having 8 children, now 10, that God has brought together in my family, growing up so that they can serve the Lord and honor Him and glorify Him. And I put a lot of effort into that. My wife puts a lot of effort into that, because it's probably the most important thing we're going to do while we're here on this planet. And then there's certainty. The marriage is made to be a covenant, which means it's not a contract that can be broken by mutual consent. It means that I have a covenant with God for a lifetime of marriage to my wife. And then there is Christ-likeness. Because what should be happening is marriage has a way of helping shave off our rough edges to make us more like Jesus Christ. Now, we talked also about some problems in marriage. Why do problems happen? Well, a lot of it's due to ignorance. First of all, people don't understand this authority submission thing. It's been beat to death in the churches and preached wrong most of the time. Submission is not, I'm going to do everything my husband tells me to do, period. Okay, that's not what it means. Submission means that I am trusting God to work through my authority for my best good. Now, sometimes you may have to appeal to that authority. Sometimes you may not agree with that authority. You may have to very generously and very cautiously and very tenderly share your concerns. And as authorities, we're not to run roughshod over those who are under our authority, but we're to listen to them like a radar that keeps us from flying into a mountain. And so we listen to their point of view before we make that final decision about whether or not to do any course correction, or whether or not to stay on the same course that we're already on. But we need to understand that submission isn't about I command, you do. It's about that we are arranged together for the glory of God in our marriage, and that we trust one another. I trust my wife to be my radar. She trusts me to hear from the Lord and make wise decisions, and that we trust each other to work together. And then also there's ignorance, I think, between of understanding what it means in Genesis 2, where it says that when the God tells Eve after they've sinned, He says, your desire shall be to your husband, but he shall rule over you. And we don't understand, because we haven't gone to the next chapter of Scripture where it talks about Cain and Abel, to find out what that means. But it means that husbands have a tendency to react to their wives the way Christians should react to temptation. We cut off communication. If you see something tempting, walk away from it. And yet, what do we do with our wives? Very often, we walk away from them. When you should claim your authority as a child of God to not have to yield to temptation. And what do men often do when there's a disagreement with their wives? They just say, it's my way or the highway. I'm in charge here. We basically remove our physical presence from them, just as we should from temptation. We basically treat our wives sometimes like we should be treating the devil. And that's, we need to understand what that verse means. It doesn't mean your wife wants to run your family when it says your desire shall be your husband. It means that you're going to desire intimacy with your husband, but sometimes he's going to rule over you kind of uncomfortably. That's part of the curse. And men, if we want to get our families away from the curse, we don't need to just claim authority. We need to listen. We need to love. We need to be tender with them. And then another reason for problems in marriage is insecurity. The whole idea of that I can leave the cleaving at any time. The whole idea that, hey, I dated a bunch before I got married, and it was all try before you buy, and you know what, the same principle applies here. If this doesn't work out, I can always get, you know, divorced and remarried, start things over again. And then there is iniquity. I think the things that attack marriages the most in our churches today and in our land today are the big three. The lust of the flesh, okay? That's immorality. That's pornography. That's those things that keep us from being faithful to our married spouse. And then, and by the way, interesting enough, pornography is not just a men problem anymore. There's a great number of women who are also have a difficulty with that. And then there's lust of the eyes. That's greed. It's materialism. It's always wanting more. It's always caring more about things than you do about relationships. That's all part of it. And then there's the pride of life, which is bitterness. It's where we fail to forgive our spouse. We fail to forgive others. And whenever you fail to forgive someone, you build up bitterness in your heart, and that bitterness keeps you from properly responding to those around you. That bitterness causes Satan to send out tormentors in your life so that you react rather than respond, so that you have uncontrolled outburst of anger, you have depression, you have suicidal thoughts, maybe you have eating disorders. All these things can be caused in our lives by bitterness. Now, we also mentioned last week the platform of marriage, which was three words, but I only gave you two of them. And we looked at this passage in Genesis 2, and it says, you know, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, made he a woman and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. And then Moses makes this comment. He says, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother. That was the first thing, leaving. And shall cleave to his wife. That was the second thing. And they shall be one flesh. So I said there were three keys to marriage. And I only gave you two. And I realized after I got in the car, went home, I thought, I didn't give them the third point. See, leaving, and of course, doesn't mean that it's, you know, you disrespectfully get away from mom and dad, you never have anything to do with them again, and that's sad that a lot of people leave home and simply forget their parents. That's not what's intended here. It means that you lessen your dependence on them. You no longer depend on them. You're solving problems on your own with the help of the Lord, but you still are in a relationship with these people. So it's the idea of leaving. And then there's the idea of cleaving. Like the way your skin sticks to your bones, you stick to your spouse. And you know that you can't ever dissolve that relationship because it'll tear a part of you out as well. And so there's the idea of cleaving. It means to make that person your biggest priority on earth other than honoring God is to cleave. But here's the third word. This is one I didn't give you. You need to leave and you need to cleave, but then you need to weave. Now, by the way, when I say weave here, I do not mean bob and weave for those of you boxing aficionados in the house. I don't mean bob and weave, duck, you know. And there are some marriages where that may be the best advice you can give somebody is duck. You know, but that's not how God intended it. It means, when he says the two shall be one flesh, he's not just talking about the fact that a man and a woman get married and they have babies. Okay? That's not what it means strictly to be one flesh. It means that your lives become so much a part of one another that you can't ever think of yourself again. It doesn't matter if I'm in a restaurant or a hotel in Virginia on a business trip. The fact of the matter is that I can never really think of myself by myself anymore. I think as a unit. I am a married man, and everything I do reflects on that marriage. Everything I do reflects on the kids. What I do spiritually when people aren't watching could potentially affect those who are under my authority, because if I do something wrong, I could be putting a hole in my umbrella and the devil can rain down on them. I have to be married, and I have to be a dad no matter where I'm at. That happens all the time. But there's also, when God puts two people together, they're pretty different. Now, about the only thing, you know, for some reason, Judy and I enjoy all the same restaurants. That's the one great weakness we have together. And we try to spend time, you know, at least once a week as a couple, just out by ourselves, eating together. We enjoy a lot of the same things together, and we've cultivated a lot. I have finally, I have learned to like going to the symphony. I like the music. I do think that Dvorak didn't know how to spell his name because it looks like Dvorak, okay? And he's not the only one that didn't know how to spell his name. I mean, it looks like Ludwig instead of Ludwig, okay? Let's fix these people and their spelling. But at any rate, I have learned to enjoy that. And, and she's been to the gun range with me, okay? And so, and she's skinned her smoke wagon a few times. If you shoot a lot, you know what that means, to skin your smoke wagon. It means to shoot your gun, okay? So she's been out there with me a few times. But we weave our lives together and we cultivate common interest and we enjoy each other's friendship. We enjoy each other's relationship. But you know, this is where the real work of marriage comes, because God puts two fairly different people together. And almost every marriage, you'll have one person who is a morning person and one person who is a night owl. And the problem is just when you're getting used to how that reconciles, y'all switch. So when Gina and I got married, I was the night owl. Boy, 8, 9 o'clock at night, she's out, but she'd wake up before I did. Now, man, if I'm sitting still at 9 o'clock at night, my eyes are closed. But, I may wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and, if I want to, I may stay there a little while, but I generally wake up about 5:30 in the morning without an alarm, if not a little earlier. But it's fascinating. We kind of swap places there. So once you get used to it, you probably won't be that way anymore. And then you get something else to adjust to. But it's this idea of weaving together. But this is where the real work of marriage comes, is in maintaining and improving that relationship so that you're constantly getting closer together. Let me tell you something you may not understand. Marriage does not have a park or a neutral on its transmission. It is either moving forward so you're getting closer together, or you are backsliding and drawing away from one another and you're becoming less intimate over time. So we need to learn how to weave. And in the weeks to come, I want to talk more about that. But I want to talk about, how do you bring life to a dead marriage, or to a marriage that just maybe is having trouble? And there's an old poem I want to read you. It's one of my favorite poems. I'm only going to read you half the poem. Now, if you ever go look at the other half of the poem, it has a surprise ending. So y'all might want to go home and Google. This poem is written by a fellow by the name of Joseph Malins in 1895. And it's called The Ambulance Down in the Valley. And I think I've seen it with one or two other names. But just listen to this for a minute. "'Twas a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its crest was so pleasant. But over its terrible edge had slipped a duke and full many a peasant. So the people said something would have to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, put a fence around the edge of the cliff, and some, an ambulance down in the valley. But the cry for the ambulance carried the day, for it spread through the neighboring city. A fence may be useful or not, it is true, but each heart became full of pity. For those who had slipped over the dangerous cliff, and the dwellers in highway and alley, gave pounds and gave pence not to put up a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. For the cliff is all right, if you're careful, they said, and if folks even slip and are dropping, it isn't the slipping that hurts them so much as the shock down below where they're stopping. So day after day, as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would those rescuers sally to pick up the victims who fell off the cliff with their ambulance down in the valley. Then an old sage remarked, it's a marvel to me that people give far more attention to repairing results than to stopping the cause, when they'd much better aim at prevention. Let us stop at its source all this mischief, cried he. Come neighbors and friends, let us rally. If the cliff we will fence, we might almost dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Now, what's the point? And you really should read the rest of it, because it has a rather surprise ending, by the way. But what's the point of that poem? When you talk about marriage, some people tune you out because they're not married. I'm single. I don't need to know how to fix a marriage. Or they have gone through the tragedy of a divorce themselves. They're not married currently, and they think, okay, well, I can just switch off for a little bit here. Let me encourage you that if you have a good marriage, well, first of all, if you're in a marriage that's suffering, you need to hear what I have to say, so listen. If you have a good marriage, chances are that things will happen that will put stress and strain on it over the future, or you may just get a little careless over time, and you will eventually need what I'm going to say. So listen. And if you're single, one day you will be married, and you may wish that you remembered what I said, so listen. And if you're divorced, you may have the opportunity to help someone else to keep from going through the same kind of suffering you went through that ripped your life apart. So listen. So I say that, and let me also give you one more thing. I want to talk, you know, marriage is a picture of the relationship between Christ and His church. So even if you are single, there's going to be things in here that you will understand in a different way because you won't be thinking about your husband or your wife, but you can be thinking about how Jesus treats you as we go through the story that I'm about to share with you. So let me talk about the story of Hosea. It is one of my favorite Bible stories, and every time I look at it, I see new nuances and new bits of meaning there. So let me give you a little bit of this story, this whole book in the Bible about it. Hosea is written primarily. Hosea was a prophet we don't really know a whole lot about. We know he lived at about the same time of Amos. Amos was quite famous. He came from a wealthy family. But Hosea was kind of a poor prophet. He was from Israel. He preached his message to Israel. And the message was Israel was leaving God. They were leaving behind their affiliation with God. They were taking on other gods. They were building alliances that were not healthy for them. And they were going downhill as a nation. Does that sound familiar to anybody else besides me? Kind of sounds like the United States right now, doesn't it? Now, so God has Hosea do something very unusual because He's going to make Hosea be a living sermon illustration of what's going on in his relationship to Israel. And because Israel is basically prostituting themselves by going out to the world and making alliances instead of trusting in God, God tells Hosea one day, He says, I want you to go marry a prostitute. Now that's kind of an unusual start to a marriage relationship. So he marries a woman by the name of Gomer, and very quickly their marriage turns sour. See, she had a basic lack of character. Now, when God tells you to marry somebody, you should, but be aware of the fact that if you're going through the courtship process, look for character. And so things go so bad, in fact, that when the first child is born, Hosea names his child Jezreel, which means scattered, because he had already gotten every indication that his wife's affections were not focused on him, but his affections were scattered. And then the second child they named Lo Ruhamah, which means no compassion, no pity, no love. That's a pretty poor statement about your marriage, isn't it? And then the third child just gets an outright name, Lo Ami, which means not my child. And fact is, we get the evidence from a statement made in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 4, that he refers to all of them as children of her whoredom, so it's very likely that none of these children were his children. Now, I hope your marriage never gets this bad. But let me give you a thought. If God could fix this marriage, He can fix any marriage. So, let's look at what he does. So what happens next? Well, Gomer gets tired of the home life, and so she decides to leave and go back and ply her old trade. And so the Bible says that in chapter 2 and verse 8 that he sends her some gold and some silver and some corn and some oil and some fine linens. He basically sends her gifts and begs her to come back. He even sends the kids and says, kids, I want you to go get your mother back. And he's really nice to the kids. He doesn't call them by their regular names in chapter 2 and verse 1. He calls them Ami, which means my child, and Ruhamah, which means beloved. He says, go talk to your mother and tell her to come home. This guy's a class act. More so than most of us would be under such circumstances. And then, before he publicly exposes her, and basically there's kind of a warning. He says, kids, you need to call her back, because if she doesn't come back, there are going to be repercussions. There are going to be consequences. I will publicly expose her for her sin, but we've got to try to restore her first. It may come to that, but before it comes to that, let's try to bring them back. And so he says, you know, I'm going to pray. He says, I'm going to put a hedge around her. And Hosea prays for God to erect a hedge so that every time she would pursue a lover, they just wouldn't want anything to do with her. By the way, parents, let me give you a little clue. When you see your friends, you see your kids making unwise friendships and it's having a negative influence on them, start praying a hedge of thorns over your children so that any who are ungodly would turn away from them and would not want to have anything to do with them. If you ever do see a spouse being unfaithful, start praying a hedge of thorns around them so that they would, all the wrong people in their lives would turn away from them and want to get out of their lives, not to want to have anything to do with them. And he says, I want to pray a hedge of thorns around her so she can't find her way. In other words, she's going to be confused. She's going to be without resources. She's not going to understand how to make life work. And hopefully that'll make her want to come back to me. By the way, have you ever gotten in a situation in life where you got a big wake-up call? You were doing something stupid. That stupid thing was about to destroy you, destroy your family. You got the wake-up call and now you say, oh, I need to come back to God. I need to get my relationship to God right. We need those calls every now and then, don't we? And that's because we need God to say, hey, you can't find your way anymore. You got to come back to me. Now, the good news is the marriage does get healed, but things keep getting worse before they get better. How many of you ever noticed that sometimes when you keep thinking things will turn around, they get a few steps worse before it finally happens? So Hosea is shacked up with a guy on the other side of town. And basically, he has debts, so he sells her into slavery. You say, well, how could he do that? Women were just basically chattel or property in this day and time in this particular part of the world. And so he just sells her into slavery. So the Bible says Hosea goes down to the auction barn. And in chapter 3 of Hosea, we are told that he pays 15 pieces of silver and then 15 homers or 1.5 homers of barley, which is about the equivalent of 15 bushels of barley. Interesting thing about this is that a pretty slave girl, one that looked good, one you'd like to have around the house, ran about 30 pieces of silver. Pretty interesting number, by the way, 30 pieces of silver. You can think about that in New Testament terms, and you may come to some analogy there. 30 pieces of silver was the full price for a pretty slave girl. Gomer's no longer pretty. Okay? She's an older woman. The vile, the beauty she once had has been trodden underfoot of the vile passions of sinful men. And there's nothing pretty left about her. You go down to the auction barn, and they have the sheep here, and the goats here, and the cattle here, and down here is a big block. And they bring the slaves up on the block in handcuffs and their feet chained together. Wearing little or nothing, and they offer them for sale. Now, Hosea wasn't a rich man, not like Amos would have been. Hosea didn't have a lot of money, and he scraped together literally everything he had, and all he could come up with was 15 pieces of silver. And quite frankly, 15 pieces of silver is more than enough for a haggard-looking woman who's really of no virtue whatsoever and has no loveliness whatsoever, that would have been too much to pay. But in love, he pays the same price for her that he would have been able to buy a young, beautiful slave girl for. And since he didn't have enough money in silver, he made it up with 15 bushels of barley, which would have come to about a total of 30 pieces of silver. And basically, he pays full price for somebody that, quite frankly, wasn't worth a plug nickel. Isn't that amazing? See, I don't know if you're getting this yet, but God commended His love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That I wasn't worth loving, and yet Jesus came and gave all that He had, which was His own life, to buy somebody that, quite frankly, wasn't worth loving, was ugly and repugnant in the sight of God. But he allowed himself to be nailed to the cross for a person by the name of Robert Rowland. Or by a person with your name. You see, this is a beautiful picture. And in Old Testament terms, God said, Israel, there's really nothing beautiful about you anymore. You don't have any special relationship with anymore. You've gone out and plied the harlot with all these other countries and their gods. And yet, I love you so much, I'm going to pay the ultimate price to bring you back to me. Now, here is the beautiful thing. After Hosea gets her from the auction barn, in chapter 2, we read that he takes her to a deserted place to rebuild his marriage. So would you look with me at Hosea chapter 2? And I just want to read what he does here because it's really phenomenal. Hosea chapter 2. And I just want you to look to see what he does. Let's begin at verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. And I will give her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. And she shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Now you notice we're kind of mixing here. Doesn't mean Gomer came out of Egypt, but we're mixing here the symbolism of Israel and God, as well as the relationship of Hosea to Gomer. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, which means husband, and shalt no more call me Baali, which means master. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and with the fowls of heaven and with the creeping things of the ground. And I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth and will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. I will betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Now, and the rest of the story, and by the way, you keep seeing this thing happening in the book of Hosea, where you kind of go back and forth between Hosea's marriage and God's marriage to Israel, and it shifts back and forth, sometimes several times within the same chapter. But they both have the same story. And all good love stories, of course, have the common ending, and they lived happily ever after. Hosea and Gomer eventually do have a rebuilt marriage and a restored relationship, and she does live with them faithfully the rest of her days. So this is really about three stories all happening in parallel. You have Hosea's relationship to Gomer, you have God's relationship to Israel, but you have what Jesus Christ has done for you. All in the same story. That's pretty cool. Now, here's the things I want you to write down if you're married, if you're ever going to be married, and file away for the future when you need it, of what to do when your marriage is on the rocks. Or when it's failing. Or, for that matter, when you just need a new bolt in the corner of the hood to keep it from flapping around while you're driving down life's road. Number one, you need to restore the courtship. Notice what he says in chapter 2 and verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her. Now you notice he says, I'm going to allure her. Hosea did not go to Gomer and say, okay, Gomer, that is enough. It is time for us to work this out. We're going to talk out this whole problem. I'm going to explain to you where you went wrong. Probably would not be the start of a good date. So rather than getting together so he can point out all of her flaws, which quite frankly are very evident in this case, he says, I'm going to allure her. I'm going to romance her. I'm going to love on her. I'm going to be tender. I'm going to be forgiving toward her. I'm not going to evidence a critical spirit. I'm going to have a loving spirit. In other words, don't just talk about the problems because what you wind up with is an explosion. Start with courting your spouse again. Start with courting your spouse again. That's important. And by the way, let me be clear about something. We spent about 3 weeks talking about courtship. That's how do you relate to someone? How do you build spiritual unity prior to marriage? Don't ever stop courting that person once you get married. Keep courting them for a lifetime. Now, there are two things about this romance I think are pretty interesting. One is he takes her in the wilderness. He gets her away from things for a while. sometimes the only way you're going to really work on your marriage is to have a little retreat. Maybe you find somebody else to keep the kids for 4 or 5 days, and you go and rent a cabin in East Texas, because all relationships do better in East Texas, in my opinion. Or anywhere there's pine trees. You can go to Yosemite National Park. As long as there's pine trees, you can rebuild a relationship. But you need to get away and spend some time, just the two of you, so he takes her where they can focus on one another and doesn't have all the distractions. In other words, he's not trying to juggle his day job at the same time. And let me tell you something. When you have a marital problem, it's worth taking a day off from work if it takes that to get things together. Now, in the context of the book, Hosea's wife Gomer's hit rock bottom in her life. And by the way, that is the best time to demonstrate love to someone. It's easy to love them when they're happy and get up every morning smiling, and that they've already had a chance to go to the mirror and adjust all those ugly things that happened to us in the middle of the night. And you look at them and you say, "Oh, you're beautiful." Oh. But real love looks at them when they're kind of a mess and they're messed up, and still loves them. So loyalty and is best demonstrated during times of difficulty. So when you have marriage problems, work on restoring the courtship. Now, couples, by the way, it's kind of like, let's go to the kitchen for a minute. By the way, there's a book called Love Starts in the Kitchen. Okay, you might want to read that. But let's talk about, you get a bowl. We have a KitchenAid mixer. Now, I'm not big on appliances, but I think the Vitamix and the KitchenAid mixer could actually take over the world if you had those two things. You know, they're amazing machines. But, you know, you can get that KitchenAid mixer and you can turn it on, and it's got different speeds. And I'm not just talking about 1, 2, 3 speeds. It's got like 5 different speeds, any of which are powerful enough to pull a whole team of horses in the opposite direction. It's a fabulous thing. And, you know, but you put those speeders in and you turn them on high speed and that stuff goes, psh, spins around and you can see all the liquid spinning in the bowl. And, you know, if you stop it and you lower the little handle and the bowl comes down, you could take that bowl out and you could stir it with the spoon, but it wouldn't stir quite as fast as the KitchenAid on high speed, but you could still stir it. But once you take that spoon out, you know what will happen? The water will keep spinning, or the liquid or whatever it is will keep spinning for a little while, but without the more stirring, what happens? It goes slower and slower and slower, and then it stops. You know, I think that's a little bit what happens to a lot of our marriages, is we get really stirred up about being romantic toward one another. And then life just gets busy. I am amazed how busy my life gets, to the point that it gets so busy sometimes I forget what's really important. I'm just trying to keep up. And what happens is you quit doing that stirring of the romance, and you quit doing those special little things, and you quit saying thank you for the routine things that normally you should remember to thank you for. Her making up the bed, or her, you know, fixing your breakfast, or his taking one of the kids out to take time to talk with them. And after a while, you quit stirring, and it just sits there, and it gets stagnant. See, that's what happens in marriages, is we quit stirring. You got to keep stirring that romance. Don't focus on the problems. If you have problems, don't focus on the problems. Work first on rebuilding the romance. And once the romance is reunited, you can say, "Honey, can we talk about this one thing?" But first, you're already holding hands again. You're already praying together again. You're already hugging again. It's a whole lot easier to talk like that. Rebuild the romance. Then learn to have courageous conversations. We're going to talk about that in the weeks to come. How do you resolve conflict with your spouse? So we will get there. But always remember that you can win an argument with your spouse, or you can win the heart of your spouse, but it's your choice which one of those two things you want to do. I'm persuaded it's better to win my wife's heart than to win my argument. You need to think about that in your own life. Number two, you need to restore hope. Sometimes we despair because things get so bad we think, I've got to just live with it the way it is for the rest of my life. Or we get to the place where we say, hey, there is no hope. I just want a way out. Somebody show me the exit door. But there, we can restore hope where there's trouble. Look at Hosea 2:15. And I will give her vineyards from thence and the valley of Acre for a door of hope. And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Now let me tell you what the valley of Acre is all about. Y'all remember Achan, book of Joshua. Joshua has already conquered Jericho. He and the children of Israel, you know, they walked around the wall 6 times on the 7th day. They walked around 7 times. They blew the trumpets. The walls of Jericho came tumbling down. But before any of this happened, God told them, you will not take anything out of Jericho. Nothing. Why? Because that's the first fruits. That belongs to me. It's going to be sacred. It's going to be devoted to me. You will not touch anything there. But there was one guy that happened to see a chunk of gold that he liked really well. This guy was named by the name of Achan. And Achan brought it back and he buried it in his tent. Now bear in mind that his family lived in his tent with him. They knew where the hole was. They knew where he'd hid. It was now the family secret. And then they come up against a little town that's only got about 7,000 people, and they say, oh boy, we can whoop this little town, a little place called Ai. They say, you know what, we don't even need to take a whole bunch of people. Let's just walk out there, we'll whoop on them. And they went to battle. They didn't even bother praying, because after all, you don't need to pray when you vastly outnumber an inferior force. Just go for it, right? So out they go, and all of a sudden they turn tail and run with their tails tucked beneath their legs, and men of Israel fall that day, and it was a horrible defeat. And Joshua, who should have known better, Joshua falls on his face before the Lord, and the Bible says, and he poured out his complaint before the Lord. I don't know if you've ever complained to God. I feel a lot better now that I know Joshua did it, because I've been known to complain to God too. And he poured out his complaint before the Lord. And when he pours out his complaint to the Lord, he says, Joshua, the problem is you got sin in the camp. There's somebody that did exactly what I told him not to do. And so Joshua has all the people line up, and they get the priest there, and he's got his Urim and Thummim out and inside the breastplate of the high priest, and they pass by a tribe, and he'd reach in. Nope, that's the Thummim. And another tribe goes by, reaches, not the Thummim. All of a sudden, a tribe passes by, the tribe that Achan's family belonged to, and he reaches in. That's the Urim. Something's going on here. So then he has every clan in that tribe pass by, and now it's just Achan's clan that gets pulled out. And then he has every family in that clan, and all of a sudden it gets narrowed down to Achan's family. And Joshua gets to go confront Achan. And that day, Achan's entire family is put to death. And the name of that place from that time forth was called Achor, which means the Valley of Trouble. Now I want you to think about this for just a minute, because God is saying here in the book Hosea, He says, I am going to give her hope, the Valley of Achor, for a door of hope. You know what that's saying? The greatest way you can bring hope back to your marriage is to restore the right priorities. Achor was caused by man having his priorities out of place and valuing material things more than he valued his relationship with God. And when you see there's trouble in your marriage, the first thing you need to ask yourself, have I made anything more important than God? Because I'll tell you a little secret. If the husband really loves the Lord and the wife really loves the Lord, they cannot help but really love one another. It just works that way. The best way you fix a man's relationship to his wife is get both of them closer to Jesus. That's what fixes that relationship. So Acre was a place of trouble. And remember that when your marriage is in trouble, don't even breathe the D word. Just say, you know what? There's hope. How many of you can honestly say that Jesus Christ really changed you, yourself, not your spouse, changed you dramatically from what you were to what you are? How many of you can say that? And I have no idea where I'd be without Jesus Christ, and I don't even want to think about it. You know, my mother has told my kids that she came to a place in life, and I'm pretty sure it was probably a night when I was 16 that the sheriff called her from Frankston, Texas, because I was doing stuff I should not be doing. And I still wish to this day that sheriff had just thrown my carcass in jail instead of call my mama, because that was the worst thing he could have done. And I'm pretty sure that's not she gave up on me. She said she just gave me to God because she couldn't do anything anymore. Whew! Giving me to God was pretty dramatic because He didn't let go of me. He kept hounding me until I wound up where I needed to be. The best thing you can do, by the way, for your loved ones is give them to the Lord. So, you know, that's why Fireproof is such a powerful movie, is it's given a lot of people hope that didn't have any. Pray for God to restore your marriage, and He can bring hope into it. Now, here's another thing you do to restore hope to your marriage. That is, get going by stopping. Sometimes you just need to stop. Isaiah 65:10 talks about Acre as well. And it says, "And Sharon shall be a fold of flocks of the valley of Acre, a place for herds to lie down in, for my people have sought me." He says, you know, sometimes the herds need to lie down in Acre. You need to stop what you're doing and just spend time with your family and make everything else go away that's not an actual priority. And when hope is gone, stop everything else. Make that marriage a priority. Number three, restore the songs of joy. You notice that verse, it says, "And she shall sing there like she did in the days of her youth." Take her back in time to when she was young and had something to rejoice about. One of the things I usually ask someone when I'm giving a marriage counseling, a very good question, but it doesn't hurt for you to ask yourself this once in a while, guys, is, why her? Why'd you pick her? What was it about her? What drew you to her? What was it you noticed about her? What made her so special? What got things so excited that you would start doing things like pulling out chairs and opening car doors? Skills you may have forgotten since then. What made that so different? I know when Donald and Melody began their courtship, the very first question I asked Donald, I says, "Why my daughter?" And he gave a wise answer. You know, it does us good to go back and say, "Yeah, let me tell you why you're special." For me, it's very easy. God told me to marry this woman because I was too stupid to realize how special she was at the time. And I now agree God's choice was the best one. But rehearse that. Tell her again why you loved her so much. Tell her again what attracted you. And girls, do the same. Tell them again what it was you noticed in them. And I'm pretty sure what Judy noticed in me was probably, boy, there's potential that I can do something with. I'm pretty sure that because I can't think of any other reason. But can you just tell them again what it was that drew you to them and retell it? And don't just tell it to each other. Rehearse it in the ears of other people. I tell my kids all the time about things that I remember about my wife, special memories, because I want them to have those memories too because they weren't around to see it naturally. Now, become blind to the faults like you were when you're courting. See, this is the sad thing. I watch people who are dating or courting, and very often they've got blinders on already. They cannot see anything wrong with the guy or the girl that they're dating or courting. And everybody around them can see 100 character flaws with all kinds of red, wavy, explosive-looking signs with fireworks saying, "Oh boy, this is going to be bad." And they can't see a thing because they're just perfect together. And then after they get married, 8, 9, 10 months goes by, and all of a sudden they begin noticing this stuff they used to be blind to. And that's when they got to really make one of two decisions. I'm either going to choose not to think about those things and live with them, or they're going to decide, "Hey, I just can't handle this anymore. This person is so flawed. I obviously made a huge mistake." And all too often, people choose the latter. But when you're married, put your blinders back on. Become blind to the faults again. Focus on their good points and focus on why you fell in love with them in the first place. Then number four, restore the first loves. We're almost done. Remember when you're courting how you couldn't do enough for the one? I mean, you really did pull their chair out and help them on and off with their coat and open the car door for them. I got a deacon mad at me one day. I was pastoring a church in East Texas. And I walked outside. Of course, it was a country church, so when the pastor went to shake hands, he stood outside the back door. So you're seeing the parking lot, and I had talked about opening the car doors for your wives, and he walked out, and he came back about halfway. He says, "You're going to be watching me, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, I'm going to have to open the car door for my wife, aren't I? I said, yes, sir, you are. And, you know, because we forget those kind of things. We just get out of the habit. We quit stirring the pot. But love doth not behave itself unseemly. That means love has good manners. That means opening car doors and pulling out chairs. So you do everything in your power to make that person feel special and cherished and loved and treasured. But at some point, we just get so self-focused. What can they do for me? And let me tell you a little secret. When your marriage goes from what can I do for you to what can you do for me, that's bad. Becky, I'll tell you another little secret. The worst way to get your needs met is to demand them or beg for them. The best way to get your needs met is to meet the other person's needs. I'm going to say that one more time, because that was worth the price of admission today. The best way to get your needs met is to meet the needs of the other person. By the way, if you're courting or dating, be very alert to the guy, especially, but even the girl, be very alert to them looking to have their needs and their desires met. Because if they're that way while they're courting, it's going to be worse when they're married. Now, so if you want a sweet wife, be a sweet husband. You want a sweet husband? Be a sweet wife. You know, get that Love Dare book. We may still have copies here that give you some ideas for how to actively love your spouse. Then number 5, restore relational intimacy. Look what it says in verse 16. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, which means husband, and shall call me no more Bailey, which means master. And it's not saying you can be disrespectful. What it's saying is, there was a relationship in their time where it's kind of like, yes, sir, no, sir, okay, I'll do that. But it's different to treat a man as, okay, you're the final authority, I have to do what you say. And I'm going to tell you the honest truth. I'm not talking about anybody here. Okay, so it's like, you know, those old films that you watched, you know, old movies you watched from growing up, and at the very end of the film it says, you know, any resemblance to persons either living or dead is purely coincidental, blah, 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 okay? So I'm not talking about anybody here, but I have seen, and my wife will probably know one of the families I'm talking about. We haven't seen him for a number of years. I know a large homeschooling family, and the husband and I actually have quite a bit in common, but every time I have ever seen his wife, she looks like the unhappiest, most miserable person on the planet. That should not be so. Women, your smile is a crown of glory to your husband. When you look peaceful, when you look happy, when you look contented, that is a wonderful thing. And we got ladies in this church, every time I see you, I think, that's a crown of glory to her husband. I'm gonna pick on one of them. Jim Pell, you got a wife that is a crown of glory to you. She has a peaceful countenance, a peaceful look, and she's not the only one. There's a bunch of you here, but I appreciate that so much. I see it and I say, man, something's right there. Something's working there. Okay? Men, don't focus on the headship of the home. Focus on the heartship. What can you do for the heart of the home, which is your wife? And when your marriage is in the pit, it may be difficult to feel loving. But let me explain something. Love isn't a feeling. It's a commitment and it's an action. You do loving things and then later you feel loving. Then restore faithfulness. I only got one more after this and I'll be done. Hosea 2:17 says, for I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth and they shall no more be remembered by their name. In other words, God's saying, hey, my people are going to return to them. God is telling Hosea, hey, your wife Gomer is going to return to you. Things are going to come back. And after all these preceding steps, there is a new level of commitment that comes back to the marriage. And the trick to maintaining and to keep progress moving forward is to keep courting your spouse throughout your married lives. Keep courting them. So what would you do for your wife if you were courting her? You had to win her heart back this week. What would you do? Yeah, you might buy her a rose. Maybe you write her a thank you note. Maybe you give her a word of appreciation. Maybe you just don't let her pass you in the hall without stopping to squeeze her hand and say, hey, I appreciate you. That kind of thing. And number 7, that is to renew your commitment. Hosea chapter 2 and verse 20, it says, I will even betrothed, or if you, some people would say this word is betrothed because it doesn't have E on it. I'm okay with that. They used to say in marriage ceremonies, "I pledge you my troth." Somehow or other, that just sounds a little weird to me. I keep thinking about a troth for some reason. So, anyway, it says, "I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord." Now, let me explain something. Betrothal is something you do before you get married, right? You get betrothed. You get engaged to someone. What is the deal here? They're already legally married and they're getting betrothed? Isn't that kind of backwards? I think it's talking about renewing their vows together. It's renewing their commitment to one another. Now, a few years ago, I had a really weird experience. Probably the last year, I think it maybe was the last year that we went to our ATI family conference in Knoxville, Tennessee. And there was a preacher speaking on the subject of marriage. I can't even remember now who it was. Might have been Chapman Davis. I don't remember. But at the end of that seminar, they had someone come up and lead couples in renewing their marriage vows together. And of course, Judy was back in the nursing room, and I'm in this coliseum of, 15,000 people, and so you're scrambling to find each other. And so we meet in some hallway outside of a room somewhere, and my kids, Melody, you remember this? Richard, you remember it? Okay, so do you remember? Okay, you're too young. Okay, so it's been a while. But as I remember, we had four, possibly five little urchins at the time. And they're surrounding us. And you're standing there together, along with hundreds or thousands of other couples. And you're saying your marriage vows over again. And there's just something weird saying marriage vows with little kids tugging on your pant leg. Okay, I'm just telling you, that's not the way I'd ever planned it, But we renewed our vows that day. But it's not just about going through the motions of renewing your vows, which is a cool thing to do, by the way. And it makes it tough because I've made those vows twice now, so I'm like under double jeopardy to keep them, right? But it's a daily renewing of our commitment. You get up that day and you say, "I'm going to be married today. And I'm gonna put my all into it. I'm gonna court my wife today. I'm gonna serve my husband today. I'm gonna give the marriage my all." And I want to tell you, you don't always wake up feeling like that. Anybody says marriage is 50-50 is just a big fat liar. Because some days you wake up and you're both 100. Those are good days. You're fully committed. She's fully committed. Everything's great. One day one of you is 100 and the other one's a negative 20. That's mainly Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, though, so you'll be okay. But, and then there are other days where, hey, you're both just sitting here at 40, and it's like, oh, can we just cope? See, we change from day to day. Marriage can't be based on how you feel. It has to be based on your commitment to one another in Jesus Christ. Renew that commitment on a daily basis. So, isn't it interesting that Hosea gives us seven steps for rebuilding our marriage? Kind of like it's a perfect number, huh? And what a blessing. Of all the relationships you'll ever have in this life, other than your relationship with Jesus Christ, your marriage relationship will be either the greatest source of blessing or the greatest source of curse in your life. Once you are married, it needs to be a blessing. And you have to kind of go back and keep up the courtship. Let me tell you one other little thing. And that is, when you keep up the courtship, every time you invest in the life of your wife, you'll love her more. Every time you invest in the life of your husband, you'll love him more. You know why? Because where your treasure is, what? There will your heart be also. Richard's going to come up and lead us.